There's no shortage of the number nor the size of the messes that we can make of our lives. Just think of a few decisions you've made which have caused a boatload of problems. You overbought your last house, and now your mortgage payment is eating too much of your income up. Or you stretched the truth a bit on your ability to do a particular job, and now you're in over your head and not making any progress with this deadline that's looming. Or maybe you kind of made yourself out to be someone that you're not, and now you see the lies beginning to unravel, revealing you're not who you said you were. All of these are messes which could have been avoided. You've done this to yourself. There's no one to blame but you, though you've certainly tried to pass the blame on to others. We have dug for ourselves a pretty big pit, and we're sitting in it all alone. Listen to these words from Psalm 40. I waited patiently for the Lord. He turned to me, and he heard my cry. And he lifted me out of the slimy pit, out of the muck and mire. He set my feet on a rock, and he gave me a firm place to stand. He put a new song in my mouth, a hymn of praise to our God. Many will see and fear and put their trust in the Lord. I believe somebody in here this morning needs to hear David's psalm. David knew something about making big messes. He knew something about digging deep pits. And David also learned that no pit is too deep for God to rescue us, to redeem, to reconcile, to rebuild, to restore. God will accomplish his good and gracious will in spite of the messes that we make. There are several people we read about in our Bibles who were successful at making some pretty big messes of their lives, and a guy named Jacob is near the top of the list. Last month, I used a chapter from a book about Jacob called Limping with God as a sermon starter, and I want to do that again this morning. I found this book by Chad Burr to be pretty insightful and practical. And besides telling Jacob's story, the book offers some inside look at the players that surround Jacob as well, the supporting cast. So let's start with a brief genealogy, just so we all know who's who. And this genealogy identifies the main players in the neighborhood in your Bibles of Genesis 25 to 30. It starts with Abraham and Sarah. They get married and they have a son named Isaac who married a lady named Rebekah. Isaac and Rebekah have two notable sons, Jacob and Esau. Plus they had several other kids between them. Jacob married Leah and Rachel, who were sisters. And that's a terrible idea. And they had a bunch of kids between them. Esau married a couple of women who his parents didn't care for. And they had a few kids. So those are the main characters in this section of Genesis. The next important piece of information to know has to do with birthright and blessing. These two concepts, or I guess you could call them practices, come into play between Jacob and Esau. Because Esau was the firstborn, he was set to receive two unique privileges. First, he was set to receive the birthright, which means that he was in line to get double the inheritance when his father Isaac dies. Second, Esau was also in line to receive Isaac's blessing. And this was a bigger deal. God's hand of prosperity and multiplication was to be on him for the rest of his life. The blessing was a transfer of authority from the father to the son. So Esau was in line to receive both the birthright and the blessing. Now let's paint a picture of the family dynamic on the ranch where Isaac and Rebekah set up house. Their boys, Jacob and Esau, it seems couldn't have been any more different from each other than what they were. Jacob is an HGTV kind of guy, and Esau is more of a Duck Dynasty dude. The writer of Genesis tells us that Jacob preferred to stay around the tents while Esau spent his time out in the fields. Jacob grew up in the shadow of his brother Esau, never quite measuring up in the eyes of his dad. So over time, his identity became not Esau. So on the home front, you have tension between these boys. You also sense tension between their parents, Isaac and Rebekah. They openly play favorites, with Jacob being a mama's boy and Esau hanging out with his dad with their heads under the hood of a chariot. Jacob and Esau grow up in an environment where at any moment, at least one parent doesn't think one of the boys is good enough. In addition to the favoritism, Rebekah can't stand the women Esau chooses to marry. Our Bible tells us that Rebekah despises Esau's wives. That's some strong language. The bottom line, this family's messed up. These two boys fight one another in the womb, both trying to be first, and they've never stopped fighting. Here's a line from a book by John Ortberg about this relationship. Growing up, every time Jacob entered the room and his dad saw it wasn't Esau, Jacob could see the disappointment on his father's face. And it didn't take long for Jacob to be not Esau. And sometimes, unfortunately, this happens to you and me. I'm the one my father doesn't love. I'm the one my mother doesn't love. I'm the one my brother or my sister doesn't love, or my husband, my wife doesn't love. Jacob is not Esau. He has a very low sense of authority in his life, and he has a high sense of vulnerability. So this leads to a lot of suffering for this young man. But Jacob has an ally, his mama. He is her favorite, and she appears to have a plan for her favorite son to win in the end. Here are the words of Genesis 27, verse 8. Now Rebekah was listening as Isaac spoke to his son Esau. I get the idea that Rebekah may have been listening most every day and most all of the time because she wants to be in the know. And when she overhears Isaac talking to Esau about giving his blessing, she puts a very detailed plan into motion. You may be familiar with what happens next, but if not, here's a bit of information which will be good to know. When these twins were born, Esau came out of the womb, as our Bible describes, red and hairy. Very hairy. Hairy like a garment. I mean, this dude had to really look funny. So when Rebekah hears Isaac talk to Esau about the blessing, Rebekah dresses up Jacob for a costume party. She goes and gets some gloves made out of a very hairy goat, a goat skin wrap, and a goat scarf, and puts them on Jacob. So this covers Jacob's sense of touch. She pulls some clothes out of Esau's closets, which carry Esau's distinct odor. And Jacob puts on these clothes. So this covers Jacob's sense of smell. Then she goes to work cooking Isaac's favorite kind of stew. So this covers Isaac's sense of taste. And we read that Isaac's eyes weren't all that great. In Genesis 27:1, it reads, his eyes were too dim to see. So this takes care of his sense of sight. So we've got touch, smell, taste, and sight all covered in Rebekah's scheme. And now only his sense of hearing is not covered. And this nearly blows the plan. In verse 22 of chapter 27, we read this. Jacob went close to his father Isaac, who touched him, and said, the voice is the voice of Jacob, but the hands are the hands of Esau, because it's hairy like a goat. He did not recognize him, for his hands were hairy like those of his brother Esau, so he blessed him. Are you really my son Esau? He asked. I am, he replied. And then he said, my son, bring some of your game to eat so that I may give you my blessing. So I guess we can check off the sense of hearing. All five senses are covered, and then Jacob proceeds to get Isaac's blessing. Jacob walks into Isaac's tent, and he says, I am Esau, your firstborn. Jacob learns that if you can't get what you want by being who you are, maybe you can get what you want by pretending to be who you're not. Here are a few thoughts from Brené Brown along this line. She writes about fitting in and belonging. It's pretty practical. She says belonging and fitting in are not the same thing. Belonging is being accepted for who you are. Fitting in is being accepted for trying to be who you're not. And when you're fitting in instead of belonging, you're always afraid someone will find out you're not really who you look to be. And I can't help but wonder if Jacob ever felt like he belonged anywhere. In the story of Jacob and Esau, Jacob is not the only one who's vulnerable. Let's fast forward to Jacob's escape from Esau to his uncle Laban's ranch. You see, after Jacob steals the blessing from Esau, Esau vows to kill his brother. So Jacob takes off running, and he ends up at his mom's brother's farm. This uncle has two daughters. One is beautiful, and the other one was not at all beautiful. Genesis 29, verse 9 through 11. While Jacob was still talking with the shepherds, Rachel came and with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. When Jacob saw Rachel, daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and Laban's sheep, he went over and rolled the stone away from the mouth of the well and watered his uncle's sheep. Then Jacob, this is pretty cool, Jacob kissed Rachel and began to weep aloud. I mean, wow, that's some kind of kiss with quite a dramatic response. So Jacob falls in love with Rachel, and he agrees to work 7 years to marry her. After time has passed, there's a wedding feast, and guests arrive, and the wine is flowing, and night is falling, and the couple head to the wedding tent. And after honeymoon evening, here's what we read. Say this with me. When morning came, there was Leah. When morning came, there was Leah. Laban switched out his daughters. And with the wine all gone, and the sun below the horizon, and the moon in the sky, and perhaps a veiled bride, Jacob was tricked. As difficult as it seems to believe, he didn't know. He couldn't see. And he might have not had a clear head with all the celebratory toast the night that this happened. But in the morning, there was Leah, and she was not Rachel. So like Jacob growing up being not Esau, Leah grows up being not Rachel. Rachel's the pretty one. Leah, not so much. She's not known for her beauty. Just imagine this. I know this may be difficult, but just imagine this. Imagine growing up in a culture where your worth as a woman is defined by your physical appearance. I know that's hard to imagine. Imagine that your body type and your face and your skin and your age, traits that have nothing to do with your soul, that's what determines the attention you get. And now imagine a father who believes the only way he can marry you off is to fool your sister's fiance into sleeping with you by mistake. And when morning came, there was Leah. Imagine the pain behind those words. Leah wakes up the first morning of her married life, and she wonders, what will Jacob say? Will he be kind? Will he be sensitive? Maybe he will understand the pain of pretending to be who you're not in order to belong or to get what you want. But he doesn't. Here's what we read after Laban gives Rachel to be Jacob's wife too. In Genesis 29:30, Jacob lay with Rachel also, and he loved Rachel more than Leah. And he worked for Laban 7 more years. Jacob was willing to work 7 more years in order to marry Rachel, his true love, the pretty one. Jacob and Leah both may have lived their entire lives without a true sense of belonging. And I wonder about you. Do you have a place to belong where you can be yourself? No pretense, no pretending, no faking it, no exaggeration of the truth. If a church family doesn't provide a place to belong, where would you go for that? This is one thing I really appreciate about youth ministry and campus ministry. In these two environments, you get this group of young people together to rally around Jesus and his kingdom. People who would never hang out with each other otherwise. You have a football player in the room with other people who didn't even know there was a game yesterday. You have a student who's consumed with some sort of biomechanical research hanging out with a kid who dreams to be a band director. You have sorority girls and frat boys praying together with fellow students who rarely leave the confines and safety of their comfort and comfort of their dorm room. Church is a place where most anyone should be able to find a place to belong. We just have quite the mess developing in this story. First of all, Jacob's story from birth is shrouded with deception. He deceives Esau to get the birthright. He deceives Isaac to get the blessing. He deceives Laban in a part of the story, to get the best sheep. And then Jacob gets deceived through love by his uncle and his fiancé's father. You have two sisters who are being used by their father for material gain. Two sisters who later enter into a fertility war with one another. You have one son who's vowed to kill his brother when their dad dies, so that brother has to escape to a faraway land. You have a mother who schemes against her own husband. You have two parents who have ruined their two boys because they chose to play favorites and didn't even try to hide how they feel. These parents shut the door to any chance for these boys to love and respect each other. Instead, Isaac and Rebekah set up a competitive environment for their two boys to grow up in. What a glorious mess this family has created. And I can't help but wonder, had Isaac been more affirming of Jacob's differences, would Jacob have felt the need to disguise himself as Esau? Had their parents loved them both, would these boys have grown up valuing each other's uniquenesses rather than competing and lying? Let's think about a couple of very practical truths which emerge from this glorious mess that they created. I read this line, and I believe it to be true. God can't bless who you pretend to be. Let's say that together. God can't bless who you pretend to be. Jacob was a pretender. He knew how to scheme. He knew how to deceive. He could dress and act how he needed to get what he wanted. And this blessing Jacob lied to Isaac to get came with a lot of baggage. Jacob was alone. He was afraid. He was on the run. He was not Esau. He had to keep all his lies straight. And those are just the lies we know about. Were there more? God can't bless who you pretend to be. Jacob eventually received the material blessing, but did it satisfy him? In Proverbs 10:22, here's a proverb for you. The blessing of the Lord brings wealth, and he adds nothing, no trouble to it. The blessing of the Lord brings wealth, and he adds no trouble to it. When God gives us a blessing, he also gives us the ability to enjoy it. The blessing Jacob received was limited as long as he was dressed like Esau. And the same is true for us when we dress like someone else and live like someone else. If we're honest, I suppose we can all point to a time when we wore a costume. We've talked and acted and dressed knowing this is not who we really are. In fact, the person we're pretending to be isn't really even who we want to be. I faced this kind of critical crossroads in my upperclassmen days in college. I had an image I wanted to portray, and I thought this image would carry me to where I wanted to go. And I eventually realized that not only is this not where I want to go, it's not where I was meant to go, but this image was also not who I wanted to be. I got a job as a summer intern at IBM after my junior year. And then I was hired as an intern again after I graduated. I was kind of on a waiting list just for a job to open up. And what I thought I wanted, the image I wanted to portray, included Hartshafter Mark suits and BMWs. And I could see the target. But somewhere along the way, God turned my eyes in a different direction. He shifted my focus away from the status to the pictures on my coworkers' desks. And what I noticed was pictures of kids, but no wives. I noticed nice watches, but no wedding rings. And I didn't meet very many guys who are happily married. They had the nicest stuff, but it seemed to come at a pretty steep price. And maybe I was just working around a particularly driven group of employees, but finding someone with a healthy, intact family was was not easy to do. And the question God hit me with was this: why will you be any different? What makes you think you won't end up in the same place with pictures of your kids on your desk, but a broken family behind the scenes? The person I was trying to be was not the person I wanted to be, and God could not bless that. And I'm thankful God showed me that at a pretty early age. Identity is such an important topic to give a lot of thought to, especially in those later high school and early college years. One book I've given away to a dozen of students is by Donald Miller, Searching for God Knows What. If you have a junior or a senior in high school or a college kid, I would encourage you to get this book and read it with them and talk about it. I taught this material at least three times in my life as a campus minister to different generations of students, and it's all about being who you were made to be. It's a really excellent book. But here's what we're saying. God can't bless who you pretend to be. Jacob thought that pretending to be Esau was the answer to his emptiness. Instead, life got real complicated. He ran away and left his family. He ended up spending the next two decades living with an uncle who lacked integrity. The irony is that Laban turned out to be a bigger deceiver than Jacob ever thought of being. What a mess the two of them created. Which leads to the second thought from this text. Life is full of so many letdowns. You work, you sweat, you stay late, you invest and save. But then when you wake up in the morning, there's Leah. It's weak eyes. It's not what you hope for. It's disappointing. It's a letdown. You thought you were getting a chocolate chip cookie. Instead, you got an oatmeal raisin one. Such a letdown. Those of you who are married, when did you have that feeling? How far into the marriage did the letdown come? Hopefully not in the first week. Hopefully not the first month. But I bet it was in the first year. Somewhere early, fairly early on, you had the thought, this person I'm going to spend my life with, they can really be a bit annoying and selfish and thoughtless. And it's just such a letdown when that hits you. And life is like that. Life is full of letdowns. Dorm life isn't what you expected it to be. Dating is not what you thought it would be. Your first job, even your current job, there are some aspects to it that you really don't enjoy. A vacation you save for and plan for, it didn't live up to the hype. It's all Leah. It's all of it's Leah. Friends let you down. Coworkers let you down. Parents, family, a boss, a coach, they let you down. The good news is that God's in the letdowns. That's one thing we see in Jacob's story. In the end, Jacob marries Rachel, but he does have to work another 7 years. And now he's married to both sisters, and as you can imagine, it's highly dysfunctional climate. Leah knows that she's Japhe, that she's second string. She's not Rachel. Jacob knows Laban, his father-in-law, has deceived him. And over the years, and far from that first meeting at the well between Jacob and Rachel where Jacob kissed her and then he weeps aloud, far from that overwhelming first impression Jacob has of Rachel, Rachel exposes who she really is. And it turns out that this beauty queen has a pretty ugly streak in her as well. Her character falls far short of her beauty. She lies, she steals, she worships other gods. And after struggling with not being able to have children, God gives her two sons. And then there's Leah. And she has eight sons in all of this mess. And one of them is named Judah. From Judah's line comes a string of Israelite kings, David, Solomon, Hezekiah, Josiah. And hundreds of years later, one king born in a stable in Bethlehem, the Messiah. God uses the letdowns in life, the dreams that don't measure up, the expectations that are never attained, the aspirations that are never achieved. Even in this messed up, let down family, we see God at work. He uses our sins and our mistakes and our bad decisions to accomplish his plan. And that's the last thought I want to leave you with. Listen to these words from Bird's book, Limping with God. And here, smack dab in the middle of this mess, remember, which is God's holy and chosen people, we have the Lord driving up, stepping out, and surveying the scene to make sure that, whatever these silly humans do, his good and gracious will most certainly shall be done. Regardless of how big a mess we make, God's good and gracious will be accomplished. Just for a moment, think about some of the messes you know about in your life and even in the lives of our church family. I had a mentor who was a proponent of long-term ministry with the same church, and he said one time to me that it's good to have somebody around, somebody who's been around for a long time because they know where the bodies are buried. And there's a lot of wisdom in that statement. Over the years I've been here, I've known of family members who've left here because the part of their family who attended here were always up in their business. They had to move to create a little breathing space. I've done weddings for couples who hoped a particular family member didn't show up. Or at least if they did, they hoped this person would just have the courtesy to behave for 60 minutes. You probably know people who've caused a lot of trouble in their marriage. You know people who've shown their ugly streak trying to navigate a divorce. You know parents who've been inattentive and dismissive of their children. We've seen ministers fired, elders relieved. We had to secure a restraining order a couple of times. We've had people leave here to start another church. We have no lack of ability to create messes. So here's a concluding remark from Mr. Bird. What we learn from scriptures, however, is that our gracious Lord Jesus does not walk away from either created, self-created, or other created disasters. He comes marching in without a moment's hesitation. his scarred hands laboring to restore and rekindle hope. We may not see him at work in the big picture. We probably won't. But he will be there, using his word to break stony hearts, to mend cracked souls, to push forward his kingdom and his love, and to love his people by giving them his holiness and his righteousness. Here's the bottom line. God accomplishes his good and gracious will with us or without us. I get the feeling he'd rather do it with us. Even if we get in the way, and even though we make the process messy, his desire is to use us in making his good and gracious will occur. So let's go back to where we started as we finish in Psalm 40. I waited patiently for the Lord. He turned to me and he heard my cry. He lifted me out of the slimy pit, out of the muck and mire. He set my feet on a rock and gave me a firm place to stand. He put a new song in my mouth, a hymn of praise to our God. Many will see and fear and put their trust in the Lord. This morning, do you need to be lifted out of the slimy pit, out of the muck and mire? Do you need to be lifted out of the letdowns, out of the mornings when you wake up and there is Leah? God is waiting. He's waiting to set your feet on a rock. He's ready to give you a firm place to stand. He's ready to put a new song in your mouth. And you're invited to see him and fear him and put your trust in him. God invites us to work with him to accomplish his good and gracious and perfect will. And he invites you to join him in this work of transforming people. In fact, he invites you to join him in his transforming of you. What will you do with that invitation? Let's stand together and sing.